House Committee on Business and Labor to order Monday, February 20th. We've got a few bills carried over from our last week and several work sessions scheduled today. But we're going to start with an informational meeting on a caregiving presentation. So with that, I'm going to open an informational meeting. And Jan, do you have any preliminary?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I don't.
Well, let's just call the presenter.
Yeah.
So we'll have up Laura. And anybody else that you want to want along with you?
It's just me, I think.
Okay.
All right.
Just introduce yourself before
yes.
you start.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, thank you for having me here. My name is Laura Dresser. I'm a research director at a research center on the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus called COWS, the Center on Wisconsin Strategy, and people in Wisconsin find that funny. We actually don't do anything about agriculture. We do all mostly about urban labor markets and low-wage labor markets and the economy. And so why am I here? Partly, I have long done research on low-wage service sector jobs. I know a lot about hotel housekeepers, but I'll put that aside. Also, child care workers and home care workers. And in the course of my research, I'm a labor economist by training. I have a PhD from the University of Michigan. In the course of almost two decades of research, the issues of care work have been central to the questions I have been doing research on. And in that work, I have written a paper that people in Oregon read, and then they asked me to participate in this project studying care work in the Oregon economy. I believe this document, the Oregon Care Economy, both the executive summary and the full document, have been dropped off in everybody's office. If you need one, please let us know. But anyway, so I'm here to talk about that report and to talk about some of the issues it raises in this state. The first thing I guess I would say is that this is not something, I would say that this is a kind of invisible and under-invested and under-studied and seen set of jobs. I think we tend not even to think about what we mean, what the care economy would mean. What I mean by the care economy is very, very inclusive. I mean all the people who work with children in their first days of their lives, whether they're paid or unpaid, all the people who work with the frail or the elderly or anybody in the last days of their lives, whether they're paid and unpaid, and at every stage of life in between. I mean workers who work with providing support, essential support to people so they can live independently. I also mean workers who provide the essential care to people who cannot make any decisions for themselves anymore. So the whole range of life is covered by care. And you all have done care. You all have received care. We all have. Sometimes workers are paid. Often it is just part of our lives. And I think because it is so intimate and personal, it is also very easy to undervalue it, to imagine that it is a job done without skill or without the need for some real deep skills. And I think we kind of have structured the work systematically that way. So I think generally people will talk to you often nationally. People think specifically about care work or child care subsidy issues or whatever. People think specifically about family life balance. People think specifically about home care or nursing care worker wages. I want you to think about the care economy, what we do, both paid and unpaid, in people's most needy moments, and how we treat that systematically as a society. That's what I'm asking you to see today, and that's what this report focuses on. I've sort of split it then with the co-authors into two groups. One is the paid care workforce, and there you've got about 70,000 workers, 55,000 of whom are in different kinds of care to the elderly or the disabled, hands-on health care. So that would be home care workers paid directly by the state through Medicaid programs. It would be nursing home workers and home health workers, home aides, home care and personal care workers working in homes through private agencies. That's the bulk of the workforce. Another 14,000 workers in the state in child care. One reason I put all these workers together, even though they look so different, and this is something I learned nationally first, is that the wages of those workers are basically the same. And they're very low. These are fast-growing jobs, especially on the healthcare side. The wages in that sector are in both healthcare and childcare are basically $10 an hour. The benefit structures are weak. This is true of all low-wage jobs, but especially true in childcare and healthcare. In the frontline healthcare positions, generally workers at $10 an hour. Generally, workers without access to a health insurance through their employer, generally no retirement benefits to speak of. So low-wage jobs, very weak benefit structures, and I think some very unique problems in hours of wages, especially on the home health side, where if you're going into people's homes, people tend to want a visit, you know, their daily visit in the morning. It's very hard to get stable hours. Also, the home health structure tends to be that if your client gets sick or goes on vacation, you lose your hours, right? So that the volatility of demand on the home health side is totally carried by the worker. Another way that wages are, the income, the standard of living generated by the job is even lower than the low wages that the low wages suggest. So that's on the paid side. I want to think a little bit also about unpaid care. And here, this is just a little more precision, and this is in your report about different wages in different sectors. They're going to be basically around $10 an hour. As your minimum wage increases, the floor will lift these workers up off the floor, except for workers in family home providers who are private businesses. The minimum wage does not change what they can what they earn, and the wages tend to be below the minimum wage for family providers anyway. So that's probably the special sector to watch. People who provide childcare in their own homes, very low wages, not impacted by minimum wage increases. And I have a quote, a story from Lindsay up there, but who was a childcare worker and left the field because the wages were so low, it was not possible to sustain her life. I'll let you read that quote. But I want to talk to you also about unpaid work. Unpaid care work is very hard to measure, of course, because you know, if I take my kids shopping, is that care or is that shopping? Right? It's how we integrate care into our lives is very hard to separate and measure. Even so, at very conservative measurements of what is going on in care in this economy, 1 in 4 women are providing care for children in nationally, and so by extension, I assume in Oregon, 1 in 4 women are providing care, at least 2 hours of care a day. 1 in 7 men providing care at least about an hour and a half a day. If you just look at that very constrained and conservatively measured amount of care, that's $500 million hours of care a year in the state of Oregon, a workforce of 176,000 full-time equivalent workers. So care happens for pay and creates that 70,000 jobs, but even very conservatively measured, a workforce of 176,000 full-time equivalent is going on in care, right? That's That's the shape of the unpaid care labor market. And I would say that there's essential problems through each lens. This gets at the first essential problem of through the eyes of a child care worker or any care worker, the most essential problem is the wage. But if you look through other people's eyes, they have essential problems with this industry as well. Anybody who is purchasing care or providing care, there is a cost problem if you're purchasing care, and there is a stress problem for those who are providing care. So I think almost systematically across, you know, all the people who are interacting in the care industry, which is all of us, but some of us much more intensely than others. So when your children are little, and if you put them in childcare, you're paying, the cost of childcare for an infant for a year in Oregon is $14,000. That's I think the 65% of providers are at that price or lower. That cost is prohibitive. Obviously, you just imagine dropping $14,000 even on, you know, a substantial income, very high cost, right? So any family facing that cost, it's prohibitive. You go down to earning $20,000 a year or $30,000 a year. That's $10 an hour is $20,000 a year, $15 an hour, $30,000 a year. Half your money is going to childcare to provide full-time quality care for an infant. So the cost problem you've heard of, I know, but is prohibitive. The wage problem at the same time and contradictorily, right? Like people want to say, well, if it's going to be that expensive, at least the workers must be paid. Well, they're not, right? So on the worker side, a real problem. On the purchaser side, a real problem. And then on those who are trying to fit care into their own lives, a real question of stress. And so part of the point of this report is to see all those problems as related instead of as separable and distinct. They are the same problem in a way, and it is an underinvestment in the care economy, an underinvestment in individuals' ability to provide care and have income while they're providing care, an underinvestment in the wages we provide to people who work for care, and an underinvestment in the ways that we support care for people when they're buying it. All three ways. Real problems. Another part of the report that I want to emphasize is that that care work has payoff, that investing in that infrastructure, seeing the care economy and investing in the care economy has real gains that we are also not able to capture. One, you can see international comparisons that a stronger investment in the care economy helps women connect with work better. It makes their leaving the labor market less likely because they feel more secure about the care options, and that if they leave less, they are able to earn more, become more meaningful at their places of work, and to be paid more. It also increases the increasing the quality of care makes a big difference for the people who receive care. If you raise the wages for care workers, the care workers are able to stay around. And the relationship between the care provider and the person who's getting the care is stronger. And especially in children, that has long-term benefits. And so investing in kids, I know you've heard this before, but investing in children by investing in that stability of the workforce that works with children pays off in terms of the kids' abilities to move into the labor market and contribute to the state later on. So gender equity, economic growth in general, and a help to low-income families. These problems are serious for everyone. You can see these problems in any, you know, in any neighborhood you go to in the state of Oregon. You are going to find people who face these problems of concerns about quality or costs or the stress of providing care and trying to work. But low-income families face these problems in an especially intense way. And that's true both because these are low-wage jobs, and so women in these jobs face the problems of this work as the workforce that provides this care, and also because the cost of care is so high And so hard to secure if you have a variable hours job, for example. So a lot of retail and food service now jobs scheduling you just in time, almost impossible to buy care in those situations. So there's all sorts of ways that, especially at the low income level, the lack of investment is really uniquely hard on low income families. And so you get some help on equalizing outcomes. You get some help on the long-term growth of kids. You get some help in terms of gender inequality by making women's choices easier and helping them connect better to the labor market. And so then just to close quickly with what to do. The first one, that the three elements of what could make, what kind of policies help strengthen this care economy to try and think about together. One is paid family leave, which is, I know, something that you would consider. And paid family leave is a way to help families provide care when the need is most intense, to when they want to be the one in the first days of life or the first days when a child is introduced into a family. Those are moments when people really want to be the ones. Families want to be the ones to provide the care. Paid family leave allows people to have the income security to provide the care when they need to the most, when the need is most intense. Thinking systematically about affordability and accessibility on the child care side and on the senior and home health side. And finally, thinking about the centrality of wages to the question of quality and improving the quality of the workforce, but also the wages that they're paid, so that those move together. And this, that kind of list of policy is a way of making a kind of comprehensive investment in families and care. And that's, and now it's like you've read the paper. So I think that's what I've got for presentation.
Thank you. It's pretty interesting. Any questions from the committee about any of this? Representative Barreto.
I have one. I have a friend of mine who works for DHS, and she's concerned about a lot of these home care workers and the lack of drug testing. They're caring for elderly. They have all these drugs available, and as far as they do a background check, I think, on them. But as far as other screening, do they do any kind of other screening?
I'm not familiar in any with the structure of screening in Oregon specifically, so I can't speak to that. I can say that, you know, it is when you have a job that is basically at the bottom of the labor market, even when you're trying to, you know, move the quality up, it's very hard to move quality without moving wages. And so the issues on screening and the quality of the workforce are endemic. You know, they're written in by having a wage that puts them basically at the level of food service and retail. And if you're not going to move the wage above that, you're going to have serious quality issues in terms of turnover, in terms of people who are not as interested in the jobs. If you make the job something to be interested in, you can get better quality out of that, and you can require training and expect greater things.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Byron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your presentation. I just wanted to make a comment and ask just a little bit of a question on the delta between purchasing child care and the wage of the child care worker. So let it be known for the record that this job does not pay enough for me to purchase child care for my four children. Just saying. Talk about the struggle that parents or families have when, you know, if the wage is $10, you as a worker, if you're buying it, you have to probably make about $30 in order to be able to afford that $10.
Right. And as you point out, I mean, it's an especially intense cost when the littler kids are and the more kids you have, right? So one infant is an incredibly intense cost. An infant and a preschooler just wipes out the entire wage. So I guess there's two questions on that kind of delta. Like, well, who's making the money? And I think the child care industry, the child care providers, child care centers are on generally on very thin margins. There's a few for-profit chains where some money is going back for expansion and things like that. But mostly the child care sector, at least I know that actual providers in the state of Wisconsin better. I can't speak to actual providers here, but it's always a mix of nonprofit and a few for-profit providers. But even the nonprofit providers, unless they have some kind of subsidy from a company or they own their building for some reason or whatever, the ratios required to provide care simply mean that even at $10 an hour, wages eat the budget. And so there's not, I mean, it's not the case that if only we figured out how to get the money out of the, you know, the sector, there was a lot of money left over for workers. It is simply a combination of, you know, we have ratios required to provide the quality care. Increasingly, states are asking for levels of education in child care, which I think is laudable, but has moved largely without wages, without attention to wages, or a direct way to get into wages. And I, you know, one of the things that's just obvious on this to think about is the difference between a kid before school and a kid when they go to school, right? Like, then all of a sudden, you're liberated from the cost of care. And we pay teachers in the schools as if it's a profession. And then so basically for the first 4 years of their lives, the kids are your private concern. And then bing, they're a public concern. Well, they're a public concern all the way along. And the investment only starts when they get to school. The serious systematic investment only starts when they get to school. And I think serious systematic investment has to start sooner because you can't solve the problem off of, you know, there's no magic in that difference. It's just, the industry is expensive. It's expensive to take care of kids.
Thank you.
Other questions? Comments? I know that trends show over time, I think, that families rely on two incomes for survival anymore as opposed to just one, perhaps, in the 50s and 60s. And so that sort of probably exacerbates this issue a little bit, but you know, you're talking about investments. How, I mean, when you look around at other countries, I don't know if Canada experiences the same sort of issues in Europe. And, you know, granted, they may have slightly different, you know, political structures. But what do you see as the solution to this? I mean, is it really just, you know, the state coming up when, you know, incorporating in our schools daycare and, you know, socializing that cost? Or is there really a direct way to address this?
Well, I would say that, you know, there are numerous approaches by many countries. I mean, I think paid family leave is something that you can see almost every, you know what, there's a handful of countries that don't provide for paid family leave. But they tend to be undeveloped countries without the tax base to do it. So paid family leave, the idea that when you need to be with your kid, you would, that is a kind of fact of life everywhere but the United States. And now, actually, California and New Jersey have paid family leave as well, but mostly in the U.S., not. So that piece of the infrastructure is more ubiquitous. But even Canada, our neighbor to the north, does much more systematic investment in early childhood. And it's not through schools. I think often the vision then is, we'll just, you know, like, maybe the population's declining, let's turn a room into a school. I think schools aren't right for infants. It's not the right infrastructure. So the investment is serious in Canada, but it is diffuse. It happens through neighborhood and nonprofit and worker-owned, all sorts of different provision. There's a serious investment, but it doesn't look just like the schools. In France, they have In France, they do a lot of nursery work. It's a part of their agenda of making, you know, French citizens so that they all understand the quality of the cuisine or something. You got to start early. But there it's done mostly in very small neighborhood-based nursery centers. So there's a model for every country and probably more than one. But and it wouldn't always look like public schools, but it always would look like an investment. So I don't want to say that the schools is the answer, but I also think that the public sector is a big participant on the early years of life and a bigger participant at the end of life, helping support families and seniors at the end of their lives. And there's, usually public money in that. There's probably also leverage on private money. And I think the U.S. solution necessarily will draw on more sources of private money as well. But I think the systematic answer is what matters.
Thank you. Representative Hack.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. Just quickly, just a comment. Thank you for the work you've done. I do want to defend us, I guess, a little bit in that I think we've made some huge movements in early childhood. I'm a huge advocate for early childhood and going way back even to the start of our relief nurseries to children and family services to now our commissions to now our hubs to our pre-K promise. We've got childcare that we pay for our families that not only are on 100% poverty, but we've also increased services to families at 300% poverty. So I was on the Early Learning Fellows along with Representative Peluso. I think we've made some huge strides, and having met with representatives from all other states across the United States, Oregon happened to be probably one of the leaders when it came to the Early Learning Fellows. And so I think we've made some huge strides. Can we do better? I mean, obviously, we always can do better. But I think that what we found at our fellowship was that Oregon actually is doing some significant work in early childhood. So at the same time, I'd like to commend the work that we're also doing and just be on the record as saying we've got a lot of great things out there that Oregon is doing.
Thank you. Well, I really appreciate your presentation today. Definitely food for thought.
Thanks for having me. Thank you very much.
So I'm going to close the informational hearing on caregiving and open a public hearing on House Bill 2165 and House Bill 2737 concurrently. So up first, Aaron Doyle and Eric Schmidt.
Good afternoon, Chair Holvey and committee members. My name is Eric Schmidt, and I'm representing the Oregon Building Officials Association and also the City of Gresham. Thank you again for the opportunity to submit comments for your consideration on House Bill 2165 and 2737. Both House Bill 2165 and 2137 relate to tiny homes, and while OBOA is open to having a broader discussion about the subject of tiny homes and exploring a potential solution, we are opposed to the bills as they are currently drafted. Specifically, House Bill 2165 would require local building inspectors to inspect a small home as defined in the bill for compliance with the recreational vehicle standard. This recreational vehicle standard is overseen by the State Building Codes Division and is not a standard local building officials currently inspect to, nor have a history of doing so. Regarding House Bill 2737, we do not believe that building code standards should be written as part of state statute. Codes and standards need to evolve over time, and the existing public code vetting process is a more appropriate vehicle to make revisions when needed. We feel that if tiny homes are truly meant to be temporary in nature, meaning that they would be used for no longer than a six-month time period, we have clarity from the State Building Codes Division about how local building officials can work with that, assuming that also local land use law allows those to be used. If these structures are meant to be permanent, Oregon has a well-established national and state building code process that establishes minimum standards for construction for residential structures. So again, while we have these concerns, we do stand ready to help have further dialogue to see if there is a potential solution and explore potential solutions in the future. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. For the record, Erin Doyle here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. I apologize, my voice is fading for some reason. We agree with the OBOA on these issues, and I kind of want to put a little bit finer point on some of it. One of the things that I think when we say tiny houses is we don't necessarily have a standardized definition of what it is that we're talking about, how many square feet. I think you can poll 10 different people and get 10 different answers as to what constitutes tiny. And so one of the issues that I kind of both of these bills raised for me was that we need to define whose needs aren't being met for what types of structure we're talking about. Having local officials suddenly become inspectors to the RV standards, I think, is too difficult because then it means for each one of the inspection programs, you might have different interpretations. You need to create new specialties, new certified inspectors to an RV standard because that's traditionally been done at the state level and by the state. And so that level of training isn't there for our folks. We also need to figure out with these structures. I believe during the interim there was a discussion about these types of structures and how many of them are built to a temporary living situation standard, but in fact are being used permanently. This happens for all types of RVs, obviously, but in tiny homes in particular are being marketed as permanent residences and aren't necessarily meeting the life safety standards that you would have in a permanent structure just because they're on wheels. And so if that's the question we're trying to address, I think we need to really sit down and think about what that means and how we can regulate, if we can regulate, how we monitor when something that was intended to be temporary becomes permanent. But the most important thing is that we do maintain those life safety standards for these structures. Some of our local governments are trying to find a way to use some of these smaller footprint homes to meet an emergency need to try and shift folks from homelessness into something that's got a roof and walls and security while we work on getting them into what few other available units there are for low and super low income folks. And the final issue that kind of sprung to mind is those structures that are built elsewhere, dropped off, and put onto a foundation. And do we tear those buildings apart to ensure that they were inspected properly? Or are they more like a manufactured home that need to meet those standards that are set at the federal level? So I think that the takeaway from both of these bills is that there's an extreme interest in what is considered a new technology, and we need to find workable solutions that address the actual and practical implications of having units that can be put on wheels or placed on a foundation that are all marketed in the same way, but should really meet permanent living safety standards. And how we as local inspectors play into that is knowing what codes we're enforcing, when, and who's responsible for them. I think that Director Long's discussion of some of the efforts they've made in trying to clarify that are very helpful, but I don't know that it's gotten us all of the way given the ongoing interest in the issue. We'd love to help with that, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Hack.
Chair Holvey, thank you. I'm not sure if you're the right folks to ask this question. I wish I would have asked it last week. Do we have a plan, or what is our plan to deal with all of the homes that are already existing? Will they be grandfathered in? What happens to all the ones that are already out there, or already under construction, or existing? Do we know?
I think it's really for Chair Holvey, Representative Hack. I would say that we would have to discuss that with the State Building Codes Division to really figure out how we go back and address those houses.
Okay, thank you.
See any other questions? I do want to note that I think you've correctly identified a couple of key things. You know, these bills as drafted, you know, didn't come back quite the way they were intended. You know, so they're a long ways from being done. I think, Erin, you really sort of put your finger on it. There's a lot of issues out there, and, I find it, the Building Codes Division has great merit in their positions, but as well, one of your own cities, City of Eugene, came up, which I'm very familiar with, and made some pretty good points as well. And it just occurs to me that, you know, we have people who are being allowed to, whether right or wrong, live in RVs permanently because of homelessness or because of other issues, and sanctioned by local governments across the state. Not commenting on whether that's the right policy or not, but I think many communities are struggling with, you know, how do we get people out from underneath bridges and dealing with them. And so I think, you know, we've been forced into looking at this in a new way, I think. So I appreciate your open mind on this and to work with your local governments to figure out what clarity is really needed. And you know, we'll have that discussion with the building codes as well.
Chair Holvey, one of the thing you just said about allowing these to become permanent structures by not really stepping in and enforcing, some of that is largely because complaint-driven systems only respond to people when they complain about a temporary structure that seems to be living in your neighbor's driveway for a long period of time. And I've actually inquired in my own city about how long an RV could be used in my driveway as a residence, and there is no time limit on that, and that would be the only enforcement mechanism a local government would have, and that's a land use decision, not necessarily a life safety one.
Right. Well, anyway, I appreciate your testimony. Up next, Scott Berry and Brian Krieg and Tim Fried. Oh, Tim Frew. I'm sorry. I should know that. Tim. Is Tim not here? He stepped out for a minute, but go ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Scott Berry, today here for the Oregon Home Builders Association in opposition to 2165 and 2737. I think, like OBOA, we're happy to try to find a solution with inside the code for anything that would be a permanent structure. As you get outside of permanent structures into temporary structures, I think that's a different discussion. As I kind of walk through the code differences between, let's say, the RV process and the home building process, I mean, things like structural issues pop up, electrical, plumbing. If you take one of these structures and move it over to, let's say, Central Oregon, where they're going to get 4 or 5 feet of snow and you have snow load issues, and people are sleeping in a storage area but actually, you know, sleeping there, that snow load is going to crush straight onto that area where they're sleeping. They're built typically with 2x3 construction. We use 2x6 construction. Things like insulation, energy code, which we're getting a lot of pressure to enhance within the residential community, doesn't exist here for these. So other items that, and again, I'm talking more on the permanent side, but that we have to look at insurance, bonding. You know, we have to have insurance that is for, 10 years after the home is built for construction defect. We've got a bond. We've got a license in continuing education. Those are all things that I think give us some pause. One of the proponents was mentioning building codes adopting Appendix V, and that allowed for some access to lofts. I'm not sure what they're talking about adopting Appendix V into, because it's not built to a code, so it doesn't really work. Even if they adopted it, you'd have to have a separate code for these structures. I know that we're able to build down to 160 square feet today. That seems like a fairly tiny home. Obviously, at that point, though, you're going through the full process, and it gets expensive. If they're going to be permanent, you have to look at things like residential construction, paying for park, sewer, water, transportation, stormwater, system development charges, right? I mean, those people are still going to have folks who are potentially going to be going to the schools. We pay a construction excise tax for schools. All that stuff comes into play. We can pay $30,000, $40,000 for one structure, one house, for system development charges. Again, if these are going to be permanent, and some of the other proponents were talking about 20-plus years in these structures, there's a whole set of issues I think that need to be addressed before we kind of go down that road. We're happy to have those conversations, though.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Brian Krieg, here today representing the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, their state association, the UA 290 plumbers, and also the sheet metal contractors and the plumbing and mechanical contractors. I agree with many of the things that Mr. Berry pointed out. That was a pretty good list of things, and also a couple of the construction industry folks who were at the last meeting. Also, the points that were made by local government. The issues, it's a very challenging conundrum that we have in front of us of trying to get to a point where we have affordable housing, we have people with shelter, but we also have safety concerns and making sure that the structures that we are building are done safely. But there's a few other factors on them, and trying to decide whether they're an RV or an actual permanent dwelling, and that if they're gone down the road of the RV, we have issues for two of my crafts that I represent, the electrical and the plumbing. Are we putting in the right types of systems into them? One person may be able to get by with 40 amps because they don't use a lot of things. The next person that they may sell the dwelling on down the line to, though, may have a lot of other purposes they want to do. They want to put a little air conditioner in it because they find it to be too hot. All kinds of issues of that nature. Plumbing hookups. If we're doing them for designing the structure for permanent use, or is it really used for the where you would put it into something like an RV park? It's two different situations. The latter one becomes a bit problematic if they're using a system where they're capturing the gray water in it, and then they're having to dispose of that as you do in a regular RV. Questions are there facilities really readily available in the communities for them to do that, or are they just going to walk down in the middle of the night at 3 a.m., dump the tank down the city storm system on that? There's a lot of practical situation and needs that need to be factored into this. So it's a complex conversation. We want to be part of the conversation as it goes forward, and would like to try to help and come up with good solutions.
Thank you. Tim.
Good afternoon, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. The Oregon State, as a licensed general journeyman electrician in the state of Oregon for over 25 years.
Tim, could you introduce yourself
Tim Frew, Oregon State Building Trades. As a licensed general journeyman electrician in the state of Oregon for over 25 years, I feel that House Bill 2737 undermines the strong licensing laws that Oregon enjoys, but more importantly, it's an issue of safety. The National Electrical Code states that work shall be done in a safe and workmanlike manner. A part of maintaining your electrical license, you must satisfactorily complete 24 units of continuing ed every 3 years. Along with that is a code change class, because the electrical code changes every 3 years. Knowing this, an inspector on the job knows that the person that's doing the work is educated in the electrical code, skilled craftsman. And so knowing that, the inspector has somewhat of a level of confidence in the fact that the person doing the work is knowledgeable. I'd like to go on record as stating that the Oregon State Building Trades stand in opposition to House Bill 2737.
Thanks. Appreciate your testimony. I do note that I think at least some of the proponents of these measures were, you know, at least one of the bills anyway was supposed to come back with requirements for licensed electrical and plumbing installations in the product itself. If it was a plug-in unit like an RV, that was the intent to start with, and not for something that's, you know, and it has a permanent trailer underneath that's rated by ODOT, and, you know, so it's really more like an RV. They saw that as a different animal than one that's actually set on a foundation, either from the start or later on. Those are definitely different animals, but, you know, drafts don't always come back the way you think. But anyway, I appreciate your testimony. You all make good points, and you know, I think that there will be an ongoing discussion on this. I'm going to have a work group that my two vice chairs have agreed to run, and so you can keep me out of the conversation, and they can determine what might or might not go forward. But you know, I hope there might be a a reasonable solution in the middle. Maybe, maybe not. I will note that we did get one of the people that testified in September that was building these has, you know, sent something in to us that, you know, was just talking about this unclarity where, you know, they have now left the state to manufacture these in Idaho, you know, and took their jobs with them, you know, and some would say good riddance, others would say that was a missed opportunity for us to come up with something that would, you know, reasonably look at this. But I fully agree, life safety issues, electrical, plumbing, egress, those are all, you know, something that we should have in all RVs as well. So, you know, I just think that this conversation has a little ways to go yet. So we'll, I guess if you're interested in attending or participating in that work group, to let the committee analyst know about that, and something will get scheduled fairly soon, I believe. So thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. Is there anyone else that wanted to testify on House Bill 2165 or 2737? Not seeing any, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2165 and close the public hearing on House Bill 2737. And let's open a public hearing on House Bill 2168.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is a measure you're hearing for the first time. This bill requires a municipality that employs persons to conduct specialty code inspections to provide the person with the required equipment. It requires a municipality that contracts with person to conduct the inspection to ensure that the person possesses or has access to the required equipment. And there are no amendments before you on this measure.
Thank you. Well, let's start out with Sean Miller, Aaron Van Fleet, and Ryan Tribbett.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sean Miller. I'm here today on behalf of the Independent Electrical Contractors of Oregon in support of House Bill 2168. And I just wanted to briefly discuss, you did hear just a brief description of the bill. It simply requires a municipality on specialty building code inspections to provide their basic equipment to actually conduct the inspection. And I want to describe the catch-22 that contractors, subcontractors are in today, and then we obviously want to work with the cities and others in a solution. But right now, and I'm going to use an example of a basic 8-foot ladder, and with me today is Aaron Van Fleet, who will talk about the just circumstances in every day and how he deals with these inspections. But current law, and right now a lot of the inspections, they come in on, let's say it's just an example of his service work, and I'll use this ceiling as an example and the projector equipment if that needs to be fixed in a day. Someone like Aaron would come in, low voltage contractor, fix that job, move to the next job, and he may have four or five that day. Inspection needs to come in to inspect that to make sure obviously it was safe and done according to the permit. In order to get that inspection, as you can see from this ceiling and that projector, that they're going to have to look up into that ceiling to make sure that it was done properly. Two choices, and this is the catch-22 that we're in. Aaron has to leave a ladder that day, in which case he's got to go around four or five different locations and try to get back his ladder for them to use it, because they may not bring the ladder to the inspection, or they come onto the job, they look up and says, I can't do the inspection, and fail them. And they obviously, when you fail an inspection, that's not only customer service to the contractor or subcontractor, that's what you're paying for the permit to perform that duty, but then the customer, the person who owns the facility, or maybe it's at a home, is inconvenienced as well from the you know, having to roll over and do another inspection. So the second option is, if Aaron were to leave the ladder, his insurance does not cover any liability if, again, and that's in Section 2, Subsection 2 in here, dealing with liability. So again, there's a catch-22. He can either leave his ladder, which insurance doesn't cover, because, again, he's buying liability insurance that covers his employees to use that ladder, and there's OSHA requirements and training and things that he does. He has no control over someone else using that ladder. Or you can say, or he can choose, you know, I'm not going to leave the ladder because my insurance company says I shouldn't leave the ladder and let people climb up that ladder, and therefore they come and fail the inspection. That's the purpose of the bill. And again, we may need to work on the solution is to not put contractors and subcontractors in that catch-22, whether they lose either way. And again, customer service, the customer is the one being harmed in the end for a failed inspection. And that's, we don't believe that's appropriate because you pay the permit fee to a city to conduct that job. There should be basic equipment involved in actually performing that job. And again, I think there's differences in construction. And service work, and we'll talk a little bit about that. I think you'll hear from the cities. But I want Aaron to at least describe what he deals with on a daily basis because he's in and out of these jobs quite a bit.
Chair Holvey, members of the board, I'm Aaron Van Fleet with Triton Communications. I'm a low-voltage electrical contractor. We work throughout the state, and we do small jobs, a lot of small jobs, a high volume of them, where we pull permits and we go in and do the work. Could be a 2-hour, 4-hour job. We're in and out, get the work done, we call in the permit, usually for the next day because you can't call for inspection the same day and actually get it done. So in order to accommodate certain jurisdictions' requirements that we leave a ladder, it's unfeasible, really, for my service technician to leave a ladder there and then have to bring another ladder with him to go to another job site to do that job, leave a ladder there, have another ladder with him to go to the next job site, and then have to go back and pick all those ladders up. And it just, the insurance liability issue Sean addressed already is not feasible. It puts us in a vulnerable position. So, and then the customer service aspect, just the return trips for the end user customer having to be available to open the space up again for a reinspection if the inspector fails it the first time, and then it creates a big hassle. So, and that's where I'm at.
For the record, Ryan Tribbett here today on behalf of the National Electrical Contractors Association, speaking in support of the bill. I don't really have much more to add than what Mr. Miller did in describing the problem. I couldn't really state it better myself, but I could offer a little bit in terms of the where we've been in discussions with local government, and some of them had some problems with the way that the different provisions are structured right now, and so that you all know that we're willing to accept amendment language from them to narrow in the types of equipment that they're required to bring to just the basic sort of things like up to the 8-foot ladder. And we're also willing to look at other types of language that would get at the same type of indemnity issue. They suggested perhaps some language related to someone who might be pulling from workers' compensation for an injury that might, in order to file that claim, that they would need to say they would not sue the contractor as well. So those are things we're willing to consider, and just want to let you know where that is at. We have not been given any language right now, but we hope it will be forthcoming.
All right. Thank you. Representative Hack, question?
Thank you, Chair Holvey. Just a clarification, I guess. When it comes to the actual inspection, are you going to have some language that would clarify that there won't be any equipment left or required by the inspectors that would be specific to the inspection? So I know that some of the trades, let's say elevators, they have their own specific equipment that they use to, inspect like the rope and the thickness of a rope. All the inspectors use a certain tool for that, but the trades may use a little bit of a different tool, and if that tool is left and there, or, and this is just an example of a possible conflict that I could see that could arise if you don't narrow the scope of that, and then the inspectors all use a certain type of equipment to inspect, and then a different piece of equipment is left, you'll have inconsistencies in the actual inspection, whether one may pass or may not. So are you going to narrow the scope of that to say, this is all we're going to have here, we're not going to reach into what's actually used to inspect?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hack, yes, I think we need to have those discussions on what type of equipment we're dealing with. Most of the, again, an inspection is mostly just looking at the work to make sure, you know, yes, they need to be able to, and so, you know, I use the example of the ladder because it's the easiest one, where if you are unable to look at the equipment without that ladder, there is other equipment. I think there's safety equipment on live electrical boxes, too, that have also been an issue, where if they do not have that, they won't follow through with the inspection. So I think we need to have a discussion on what equipment that is. And yes, we're more than willing to narrow that down. I think the bill, again, is the first draft. It includes any and everything. We're more than willing to, if we could solve, 80 to 90% of the problems, and I will admit that a ladder probably solves most of the problems. That's why I'm using that as an example. Then I think we've done something. But again, we do want to have that discussion.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Any other questions? Not seeing any gentlemen. Thank you.
Yep. Thank you.
Up next, Eric Schmidt and Aaron Doyle. And Mark Long, could you come up too, just to answer a question? Just and thank you. I appreciate it. And Mark, could you just clarify for the committee what a specialty code inspection is?
Sure.
What it covers?
Yeah. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. For the record, Mark Long, Administrator of State Building Codes. When you talk about specialty code related to local government, there's roughly five. So it's electrical, plumbing, mechanical, structural, and residential. Those are considered specialty codes under the State Building Codes rubric. And each one of those has a separate permitting and inspection protocol. And that's what we're talking about in different access needs and different inspection needs.
And the second part, just for basis before these two go, how this issue's been around for a long time, and it seems to me that I remember that when you got a permit, you had to provide access for the inspector to inspect the property, and that was always part of the permit. And so this is sort of a rediscussion of that issue and trying to clarify what that means. Can you give me any background on that?
Sure, Mr. Chair. Again, just for the committee's background, this is, as I've been talking to the various parties, I view it as an important issue, but it goes into the kind of the customer service side of what we all provide out there. And I've just so you know, it's fairly regional as well. Most of the things we're hearing are out of the metro area, where I think both on a contractor side, they got multiple jobs they're trying to take care of, and it's complex. And as an inspector side, you got multiple jobs you're trying to cover. And so that's where we're finding the issues. This stuff has come up over the years. We're talking about, I don't want to wade into the liability and issues. You've heard about the insurance. I think they're real concerns for the contractors. We're also talking about technology solutions and looking at permitting solutions. You say, what are technology solutions? I don't want to get out too far ahead, Mr. Chair, on this particular subject, but yeah. I think most people who know me know that we're planning for drones and other types of equipment in the future. seriously, in the inspection protocol. It's going to happen at some point. And so those kinds of things are things we're looking at. That doesn't help the customers that you heard today deal with the problems they have looking at this piece of equipment. So I think that the proponents wanted to have a discussion, and when we got together before, I think the parties here, I don't want to speak for them, are willing to kind of sit down, because I think they recognize the problem and want to sit down and work out a solution. But this has been cyclical, and it is regional as well.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks for that background. I appreciate it. Go ahead, if you'd introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Holvey, committee members. My name again, Eric Schmidt, representing the Oregon Building Officials Association and the City of Gresham. So I definitely understand the conundrum that we have here in terms of trying to meet customer service needs and yet also being able to inspect. And I think that ultimately, again, to follow up what Mr. Long said, is OBOA stands ready to have further discussions to see if there's some, you know, explore some different solutions. But we are currently opposed to the bill as it's drafted, as we do feel that the language is overly broad and also overly burdensome and costly to implement as it's written. Certainly from other jurisdictions, I know I've read some of the other testimony from other jurisdictions, and there's concerns from the City of Gresham and OBOA and our members about what this would mean, again, as it's written, with having to have ladders, scaffolding, lifts. It's just, it's pretty broad at this point in time. And so welcome some further discussion to see if there's other opportunities to find a solution and or, again, to follow up with what Mr. Long said, is are there other ways to explore it in terms of the types of permits, minor labels, what else could we do to expand and be creative to find solutions that work for everybody? Thank you.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, again, for the record, Aaron Doyle on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. I think it's mostly just a hear, and please see the testimony of all a number of jurisdictions that have these localized building programs. And also, I've been talking with the counties, and they also have the same concerns about what exactly we're talking about when we say equipment, and then a matter of how we get that equipment from site to site is also an issue of the investments that we've made, some of it pursuant to other regulatory issues that have come up from time to time in this building, trying to find more efficient vehicles, smaller usually in the end, and how we carry that equipment. On the insurance piece, we're not sure if we're the right solution to help with that, largely because that's I think there's an issue of whether we can solve that problem or not, depending upon if there are employees or third-party inspectors. The insurance needs will be different, and also I think that there's a room at the table for the insurance companies to come in and explain why they can't provide that coverage to these folks. But I would also point out that it is part of the specialty code that people who have the permit have the equipment available to provide the for the inspectors to use to complete the inspection. So it is there is a requirement already. It is placing the burden on those folks who have done the work, hold the permit, and that I don't know where those policies came from, but they are currently in the specialty code. So this would adjust, that we would have to have a discussion about how much we want to adjust that if we're going to. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Not seeing any questions for you. I might note it would be probably helpful to have an element of discussing the insurance and the liability issues involved in this discussion for this committee, probably to make a good decision one way or the other on what a solution would be. I'm not going to assign this one to a work group. I'm hopeful that the parties can figure something out and get back to us. And how much time should we give this discussion? Whenever you can, just let us know the progress before it gets too late in session, so we have a sense what the discussion is. Is there middle ground on this one? Again, I hope so. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Chair.
Is there anyone else that wanted to testify on House Bill 2168? Not seeing any. I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 2168. Let's stand at ease for about 5 minutes. Reconvene the House Committee on Business and Labor, and we are going to open a work session on House Bill 2508. Jan, can you please tell the committee what we're doing with this particular bill?
So the committee's not heard this bill. This is one of the referrals to the committee that the chair felt should be handled in another committee, and this specifically being House Revenue. So this is a measure that enrolls applicants in the investment option that's most appropriate when the applicant is applying for the college 529 plan and they don't mark how they want their investment to be made. So the chair is recommending that this measure be referred to House Revenue without recommendation, and that committee will hold the hearings on it.
Representative Barreto, first out.
Chair Hovey, I move House Bill 2508 without recommendation to the Committee on Revenue.
Representative Barreto moves House Bill 2508 to the Committee on Revenue without recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, the bill's moved to motion passes and the bill moves to the House Committee on Revenue. With that, we'll go back to the top of the work session list committee, and I'll close the work session on House Bill 2508 and open a work session on House Bill 2317.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is the measure that you heard back on February 8th. It's a bill that comes to you from the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board, and it changes the term that the members appointed to the board serve. It changes it from 3 years to 4 years, and it also removes requirements that board members hold very specific professional licenses and instead requires members to be licensed, certified, or registered by the board. The committee did hear the Dash 1 amendment, and it replaced the measure, kept the three-year term moving to 4 years, but it changed the licensing requirements for those appointed to the board. And there is no fiscal impact, and there's no revenue impact to the Dash 1 amendment.
Representative Barreto.
Chair Holvey, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2317.
Representative Barreto moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2317. So discussion? Is there any objection to adopting the Dash 1 amendment? If not, the Dash 1 amendment motion passes and the Dash 1 amendment is adopted to House Bill 2317. Representative Barreto.
Chair Holvey, I move House Bill 2317 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barreto moves House Bill 2317 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none, Jan, I assume that the fiscal impact statements and the revenue impact statements are ready to go.
Yes, we requested statements and they came back as no expenditure impact and no revenue impact.
All right. Seeing no questions, let's move to a roll call vote. Kayla?
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Aye.
Representative Fahey?
Aye.
Representative Hack?
Aye.
Representative Hurd?
Yes.
Representative Kinnamer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barreto?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Bynum?
Aye.
Chair Holvey?
Aye. House Bill 2317, having required the votes, is passed to the floor. And Carrier. Representative Bynum, would you like to carry this extremely complex bill?
My pleasure.
All right.
It's possible.
She's dying to. Could not pass. I'm so sorry. I just couldn't pass.
That's almost,
she's dying to do it.
That's almost out of order.
I think he should do it.
I'd like to, I did close the work session, so right now I'd open a work session on House Bill 2624.
2624. Mr. Chair and committee members, you heard this measure February 8th. It exempts out-of-state banks, extra-national banks, and foreign associations that hold a certificate of authority to operate as a bank in Oregon for filing any additional notice or paying fees to the department when they are conducting real estate transactions. There is no fiscal impact. There's no revenue impact. There's no amendment before you.
Senator Barreto.
Chair Holvey, I move House Bill 2624 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barreto moves House Bill 2624 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kinnamer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Last time we had comments by witness Ken Sherman that it needs a technical fix amendment. I guess that is not true.
They needed
an amendment? No. Representative Tim, would you like to come up real quick? Perhaps.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. Mr. Chair, Representative Kinnamer, I don't believe either if Mr. Sherman needed the amendment, he's now changed his mind. Sometimes lawyers do that, but I'm not aware of an amendment needed at this point.
Okay.
It may have been a different bill, perhaps.
I've got it here in my notes, and that was my quote. But anyhow, if you don't want it and you're the sponsor of the bill, I guess I'm fine.
Thank you.
Just wanted to make sure.
All right. Other discussion? Not Kayla, could we have a roll call, please?
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Yes.
Representative Fahey?
Aye.
Representative Hack?
Aye.
Representative Hurd?
Aye.
Representative Kinnamer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barreto?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bynum?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. House Bill 2624, having received the votes, is passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And fiscal and revenue impact statements all good to go. Mm-hmm. So I'll close the work session on House Bill 2624 and carrier for this bill. We have a volunteer. Thank you, Representative Kinnamer.
I'll do it.
Appreciate it.
Yep.
I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 2186.
Mr. Chair and committee members, you heard this bill on February 6th, and it is a bill that comes to you from the Special Districts Association of Oregon through the committee. It allows the director of the Department of Consumer Businesses to certify a self-insured employer group that's created by an intergovernmental agreement under ORS 30.282 as a self-insured employer group for purposes of workers' comp insurance. There are no amendments before you. There is no expenditure impact, and there's no revenue impact on the measure.
Thank you. Representative Barreto, would you care to make a motion on this bill?
Chair Holby, I move House Bill 2186 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barreto moves House Bill 2186 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on this bill? Seeing none, Kayla, could we have a roll call vote, please?
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Aye.
Representative Fahey?
Aye.
Representative Hack?
Aye.
Representative Hurd?
Aye.
Representative Kinnamer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barreto?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bynum?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. House Bill 2186, having received the votes, is passed to the floor. Carrier on this one. Thank you, Representative Evans. I appreciate it. Absolutely, Chair.
You bet.
Do we get brownie points if we volunteer?
Well, except for you.
Not this late in the session.
I'll close the work session on House Bill 2186 and open a work session on House Bill 2192.
I didn't
mind that time. Mr. Chair, committee members, this is a committee bill you first heard February 6th. It is a measure that increases the length of term that members appointed to MLAC serve. They would serve 3 years as opposed to 2 years. There are no amendments. MLAC supported the bill, and there are no expenditure impacts and no revenue impacts.
Thank you, Representative Barreto.
Chair Holby, I move House Bill 2192 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barreto moves House Bill 2192 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Discussion. Seeing none. Okay, look, we have a roll call vote.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Aye.
Representative Fahey?
Aye.
Representative Hack?
Aye.
Representative Hurd?
Aye.
Representative Kenemer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barreto?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bynum?
Aye.
Chair Holvey?
Aye. House Bill 2192, having received the votes, is passed. And Representative Hack, would you like to carry this?
Might as well I was just going to say, we might as well finish the row out. I'd be happy to.
Yeah. You caught the drift.
I got you.
So with that, Representative Hack will carry that bill, and we will close the work session on House Bill 2192. And open a work session on House Bill 2336.
Mr. Chair, committee members, you heard this bill February 6th. It's a bill from the Department of Consumer and Business Services. It allows the director of DCBS to appoint a claims processing agent for self-insured employers who default, cancel their have their certification canceled, or decertified by the director. Provides that the paying agency must repay the department for expenditures made or for the present value of reasonably expected expenditures and to reimburse costs of the paying agency. The Dash 1 amendment was discussed in committee, and it allows the claims processing agent that's under contract with the department to employ the legal counsel of their choice, and it clarifies that funds recovered from third party due to DCBS must be deposited in the same fund from which the department's expenditures originated. MLAC had voted to support the bill with the Dash 1 amendment, and on the Dash 1 amendment there is no expenditure impact and no revenue impact.
Great. Thank you, Representative Barreto.
Yeah, Chair Holby, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2336.
Representative Barreto moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2336. Is there discussion? Seeing none, is there anybody opposed to adopting the amendment? Seeing none, Dash 1 amendment is adopted.
Chair Holby, I move House Bill 2336 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barreto moves House Bill 2336 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Kayla, could we have a vote, please?
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Aye.
Representative Fahey?
Aye.
Representative Hack?
Aye.
Representative Hurd?
Aye.
Representative Kenemer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barreto?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bynum?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. House Bill 2336, having received the votes, has passed to the floor.
Speak up.
And Representative Barreto, would you like to carry that? With that, I will close the work session on House Bill 2336 and open a work session on House Bill 2335.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure is another bill from the Department of Consumer and Business Services. It allows the director of the agency to appoint up to 3-member panel of medical arbiters when requested by the party involved with the closure of a workers' compensation claim. There are no amendments. The MLAC has voted to support the measure, and there are no expenditure impacts and no revenue impacts.
And thank you. It's been requested we have somebody come up and talk to us just a little bit about this bill and the amendments. So Legislative Council, Sean Brennan, and Lou from Workers' Comp Division, I know you weren't probably expecting to say too much, but I know you're good for a few words. So, Jan, I believe the question was about some of the language in the bill that was changed that didn't seem to be addressing the substance of the bill. That was one of the questions. I guess maybe Lou, I'd address you first. Obviously, MLAC approves this and the division's in support of this bill, and you don't see anything substantive wrong with this bill going forward as written.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Lou Savage, Administrator for the Workers' Comp Division. No, the language that we proposed really was focused on the ability to have either 2 or 3 arbiters. I think Sean will address the other issues.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Sean Brennan, Legislative Counsel.
We do actually in Legislative Council make form and style changes fairly frequently to existing statutory language in order to basically modernize the language, but also in many cases try to make it remove the lawyerese and make it a little more plain in meaning. So that's frequently what we end up doing. And I think apart from what's in subsection C on page 6, just about all the other, I think all the other changes really are for that purpose. If there are specific questions about language in there, I'll be happy to address our reasons for putting that in. I'm sorry, Chair Hawley, I wanted to also remind the committee that the form and style guidelines are actually passed as rules of the chambers, both chambers, and therefore we try to adhere to those.
Thank you. Could you repeat what section of the bill?
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Was substantive?
That was on page 6 of the bill, and subsection C, the Workers' Comp Division's focus was on that particular that particular paragraph. It's on page 6 in section. Actually, I think it's the only section, really.
Oh yeah.
Okay. Page 6, top of the page, paragraph C.
Okay, so I actually have one question on the substance. It came up, you know, I have to ask this on the record because, for my own satisfaction, that it was up to a panel of three, which kind of made me wonder, why don't we say a panel of two or three? And I asked if there could be such thing as a panel of one. Could one person actually make this decision, even though there might be a panel of two or three, but only one was there? So could that one person make the decision?
Chair Hovey, my reading of the language is that it would depend on the rules the department adopts. But theoretically, yes.
Theoretically, yes, under the language of the bill.
Chair Hovey, if it eases your concern, we would be happy to put that in the rule.
That would entirely ease my concern. So
we're happy to do that.
All right. Thank you.
Ask that question instead of panel. You didn't like that answer.
I did not.
Okay.
I didn't dispute it. I just didn't like it. Because what if not everybody from the panel showed up to make the decision?
Yeah.
And there was only one person there from the panel. So it was just unclear to me. So.
Yeah. Good point.
So anyway, not probably the way I would have drafted it, but I have great confidence in your rulemaking process. So, any other questions for this panel, or this panel of two?
This panel of two.
Seeing none, thank you so much for taking the time to come down here, Sean.
Thank you.
You too, Lou. With that, where are we at?
To take a motion.
Need to hold up the bill.
So we have a motion on the table?
No. No motion yet.
Okay.
Chair Holby, I move House Bill 2335 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barreto moves House Bill 2335 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Kinnemer.
So is there a dash one amendment in it or not?
In 2335, no. Yes. This bill's unamended.
Okay, thank you.
2336, which we went to beforehand, did have an amendment.
Thank you. That's my confusion. Excuse
me. Yes, I went out of order so Sean could get down here. So with that, Kayla, could we get a roll call vote, please, on House Bill 2335?
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Aye.
Representative Fahey?
Aye.
Representative Pack?
Aye.
Representative Hurd?
Aye.
Representative Kenimer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barreto?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bynum?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. House Bill 2335, having received the votes, is passed to the floor. And carrier for this bill? Notice Representative Doherty really sat back. So Representative Hurd, I see you would like to carry this bill. So with that, Representative Hurd will carry the bill. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2335.
Almost got yourself.
No, I was going to do it.
It's not enough to do in the day. Anything else for the agenda, Jan?
No.
Committee, we're done for the day, so I will see you all on Wednesday, 1 o'clock. And I'll adjourn the House Committee on Business and Labor. Adjourn the House Committee on Business and Labor. And I'll